Hello and welcome to the I Hear Design podcast, your source for interior design and architecture news, interviews, and opinions. I'm your host, Robert Eamon, and I'm so glad you've tuned in because we are closing out our Women in Design series that we've been in for the past month or so. And this episode is special in that our very own Editor-in-Chief of Interiors and Sources, Anne-Marie Martin, has an insightful and heartfelt conversation with our guest, Amber Wernick, Director of Practice Development in Perkins & Will's Dallas office. These two women talk not only about what it's like to work as a woman in a traditionally male-dominated industry, but also how to achieve the work-life balance when raising kids, as well as how to apply universal design principles to design projects to make them more inclusive to all populations, including the neurodiverse, as well as advocating for yourself in the workplace. Some great advice for the up-and-comers in the industry. I think you'll really enjoy this final installment in our Women in Design series, so without further ado, here's our conversation with Amber Wernick.
Welcome to I Hear Design. Thank you so much for calling in and being part of this Women in Design series that we're doing. We've heard so many amazing stories already, and we can't wait to hear yours. So you just told us you're located in the Dallas office. How long have you been with Perkins & Will?
So I am a boomerang. I initially started my career at Perkins & Will.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, right out of design school. And then I worked at Perkins & Will here in Dallas for about 5 years. And then I moved out to Los Angeles. And I was out in LA for about 8 years working at Clive Wilkinson Architects.
And
focusing on workplace interiors. It was a fantastic experience and first time kind of moving outside of my hometown of Dallas.
So you grew up in Dallas?
I grew up in Dallas, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I just went to school a little bit north of here in Oklahoma, University of Oklahoma, College of Architecture. Yeah, so yeah, it was first time kind of leaving home, and I just took a leap to really dive into workplace design. Clive is a leader in that market, and I was able to work with some, just fantastic clients and projects. And then the pandemic happened. And I think I just reevaluated like my priorities, and we had just started a family. So I had my first child out there, and I just really wanted to be closer to my family and my home. So
Yeah, exactly.
it was funny because like I enjoyed the distance from my family a bit for a while, but then it's like as soon as I had my daughter, I just felt a pull to be closer to them, and I wanted her to be close to my family. So we ended up moving back to Dallas about a year ago. And at the time, I was working at Lululemon. They were my client when I was at Clive Wilkinson Architects, and one of my favorite clients. And they asked me to join their workplace design team.
Now have fun,
internally. So I was working remotely for them, and working remotely gave me the opportunity then to move back to Dallas. So I worked for Lululemon a little bit on the client side. And then I was really missing being in an office environment, honestly. Like I mean, I design offices for a living, but I miss being in an office. Like I'm a really extroverted person.
Right.
Like 3 years working remotely was like kind of took its toll on me, honestly, interaction. So, Perkins & Will actually reached out to me, and it was just good timing when they did, because I was kind of ready to get back to the design firm side of things, and they have a hybrid kind of work policy. So I'm able to be in the office like 2 or 3 days a week, which is fantastic. And I'm really enjoying it. So I've been back at Perkins & Will now for just about four months or so.
Okay.
So that's a very long-winded answer to your how long have you
been? No, we love long-winded around here. Trust me.
I'm new again.
Yeah, exactly, right? So are you back to, are you still focusing on workplace and the office design market? And is that kind of your wheelhouse? Like, is that your favorite playground to be on, so to speak?
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. I worked on a few workplace projects when I was at Perkins & Will initially, and that just really like sparked that passion for workplace design and workplace strategy. I really enjoy kind of the upfront work of like visioning and programming, yeah, which is all about like getting to know the client and like on a deeper level than just what finishes do you like. It's like, how does your business actually work, and mm-hmm, how can we, or how do you want to work differently maybe in the future, and mm-hmm, how can we like create a space that really facilitates that and supports whatever you're trying to achieve as a company. So I think that is what really excites me about it. And what I had the opportunity to do while I was out in LA was just focus on that solely and really, yeah, hone my skills and get that great experience. And I'm just excited that I'm able to bring it back to the firm where I got my start and really grow our workplace interiors practice here in Dallas. It's a completely, yeah, different market, but it's like, sure, you know, we're all trying to solve similar issues, right? So it's been fun to like see how what I've learned how it can translate, really.
Yeah. Now, are the businesses, you know, in your area, how do they compare to, you know, when you were further out west? I mean, you know, we're talking about how businesses are operating post-pandemic, yeah, and what they need. I mean, what are you seeing in terms of, you know, how they're functioning and how they're getting people back to the office? If they're getting people back to the office, how prevalent is a hybrid structure from where you're standing?
Yeah, I do. I think I was expecting when I moved back that it would be that Dallas in particular would have more of a like in-office stance, like across businesses. Mm-hmm. And what I've realized, and I think it was actually Cushman Wakefield that published this recently, was that it's only about 50% of the businesses or companies here in Dallas are back to like pre-pandemic occupancy levels. So back to, mm-hmm, like 4 or 5 days a week in the office. There's a good 50% that are hybrid. And so it is, I don't know, I just assumed that Dallas would be a bit more conservative. People, you know, taking more C-suites, taking that you need to be all back in the office stance. But it seems like there's actually quite a bit of flexibility. And I'm in the new clients I've started to work with and interview for, a lot of them, the majority of them are hybrid. Even some of our like law firm clients and,
yeah, yeah,
like people more in the financial sector that you might assume would be a little bit more of an in-person environment. They're also still operating in a hybrid fashion because for retention and recruitment, they're just seeing that's what their people want. That's how they're keeping really great people, is to just be a little bit more flexible. So it's about half and half right now, I would say, like in terms of what companies have really like, you know, continued with a more of a hybrid working policy post-pandemic.
Sure. Now, what about more inclusive design strategies? I see here that you've done a considerable amount of work in that area. Is that correct?
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to work with some companies that really like walk the talk when it comes to, yeah, activity, and it trickles down into the work environment itself, like the physical space. So companies like Google and Microsoft and even Lululemon most recently really practicing universal design guidelines, which really just, mm-hmm, they're going above and beyond ADA code, which is the accessibility code. They're going above and beyond just to make sure people that identify with all genders are able to feel safe and comfortable,
yeah,
in the workspace. Yeah. And so a couple, like there's some, I guess, more obvious ways to do that. And there's like more subtle ways to do that as well. But I mean, one of the more obvious things is just providing those all gender restrooms or even, some of these campuses that I worked on have even like locker rooms and larger amenity spaces that are even all gender. And the way that you can do that really easily is just creating like private restroom stalls.
So there's like, you know, in the locker room setting.
Yeah. So you have like a men's locker room and a women's locker room. You actually have these like kind of individual rooms that you can go into that have the toilet, the shower, a sink, like an area to get ready. And it's actually like a really nice experience because you're able to like do your thing and get ready in one like private space versus kind of like all out in the open, which can be a little bit awkward in an office environment anyways. Right. So it's kind of just like become best practice for some of these companies that are walking the talk. And I think so those that have the opportunity to build restrooms that are set up that way, where you don't have a male restroom or a female restroom, that's another way to be able to do that, where you just kind of have, you know, a wall of doors and those doors are individual restroom stalls. It just like takes that exclusivity out of it. And it just creates an environment for everyone to feel comfortable.
Yeah. Are you like, finding that clients are, they want to give that, I'd assume it takes up a lot more, you know, real estate space, and they're open to that.
It takes a bit more space. It's not as much as you would think.
Yeah.
You can make the rooms quite small, and you can also make the rooms just have a toilet in them, you know, so it can just
sure.
And then you can have a shared like sink area, and a lot of like restaurants, like hospitality environments do this already. So it doesn't take up as much space as you might imagine. And then there is, of course, like a little bit of a cost premium to, you know, you essentially just have more walls because you create more privacy. But ultimately, like they see the payback and what they're able to provide for their culture and their staff. And it's just something that especially like the younger generation, I think, is like really looking for. So it's something that they're willing to invest in. I think where the challenge falls is when you don't own your building that your office is in, you know, and you're in kind of you're on a floor with other tenants and the landlord isn't willing to make upgrades to that like common restroom space. And that's where we've seen companies, you know, invest in like a couple of universal restrooms, like within their suite, which of course a cost premium, but you know, it's worth it to them to have that option for their employees to go to. Yeah.
So there's a lot of different ways to approach it, sounds like.
Definitely. Like it can be like, you know, large scale or something, you know, a little bit more minor that really makes a big difference. And that's just one example. I mean, I think I've also seen a lot of prayer rooms or even like just like multi-purpose sort of wellness rooms that can be a prayer room, a meditation room, a nap space, you know, like just a place to kind of get away and either decompress or practice your religion, whatever religion that may be. So at Lululemon, we were incorporating like even foot washing basins for those that practice that before prayer.
Yeah.
And so just providing that within the work environment just goes a long way for your employees. And I think a way to uncover some of this is to actually have surveys, you know, and really create focus groups and really ask your employees what they want and what's missing in the office space and what could we provide to make you feel more comfortable, and gathering focus groups of people, you know, who are in wheelchairs, who, you know, have other disabilities, even like neurodiversity, we've been tackling that quite a bit. So people with ADHD and people with all kinds of neurodiversity challenges, like what can we do and bring those groups together to talk about things that we can do in the physical environment to help them, you know, just succeed and make sure we're providing different spaces and make sure they feel just as comfortable in the work environment. Really comes down to providing variety and the permission to work in different types of spaces and use different types of work settings throughout the day to just really accommodate your needs. And so
I think this kind of one size fits all office where everyone has a cubicle or a workstation and it's all the same and all the lighting is the same and all the, there's not really any place other to work than your workstation or a meeting room, is a detriment to, yeah, just the way people work today, and having that variety of a different place to go that maybe has dimmer lighting, that has, yeah, you know, more of an acoustic sound absorbing material around you, so you can kind of deaden some of the, you know, maybe distractions, you know, having phone booths or places you can like duck into if you need to have something speaking to you from your computer, like all those kinds of things. Like if you need to turn the volume up, for example, that kind of thing. And if you're out in the open at an open workstation with everybody else, you just don't have that ability to kind of get away and find those different areas throughout the office that might better accommodate you. So I think it's first and foremost variety and choice in where you work and making sure that there's permission to do so, like the culture allows you to do so. It doesn't, you know, your manager doesn't think you're not working if you've chosen to go work in like a lounge area for a minute because you're more comfortable there, you know,
right.
That kind of thing. And then, like I said, like just having variety in the lighting, because that can be really distracting to some people, and the acoustics, yeah, and even like things like providing high contrast in signage and other elements in the space, so that, you know, people where their, you know, sight is starting to go, or they just don't have 20/20 vision, they are able to make their way around the office clearly, you know, that sort of thing. It's like, it can be in the details as well. Make sure that the aging population, there's not a signage for a meeting room that's got light gray lettering on a white background. Making sure that we're taking all those things into consideration.
Let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk about your journey as a woman in this industry. How has it kind of evolved since you started? You know, were there any particular challenges that you encountered along the way? Just tell people a little bit about your story and what your experience was like.
Yeah, I think, I mean, traditionally in the architecture field, it's a male dominated field. And on the flip side, the interior design profession is really a female dominated profession. So it's really interesting, right, to have that balance really at really all the firms I've had work at. You've got, you know, I would say mostly males on the architecture side and mostly females on the interior design side. So it's been actually like a good balance that I've been a part of when you look at it that way. But there's a lot of room for growth for the opposite, right? The women in an architecture profession. And I've just seen so many great examples and mentors of women who are strong architects and are really making a name for themselves, and trying to really surround myself with those women who have the call to be in that male dominated field, and encouraging them to really like share that passion with others and mentor others. There's just some really fabulous examples, both here at Perkins and Will and at my time at Clyde Wilkinson Architects. So I've been privileged to have the opportunity to be at places that really support and value women in leadership in this industry, but I know there's a long way to go. And, you know, obviously historically being a male dominated field, that's led to issues with like gender bias and stereotypes. And I think that's something that we're still working on as an industry, but I think building that strong network of mentors and allies along the way, and I think finding those mentors and leaders that really have encouraged me to be confident and be a part of the conversations and speak up for myself has really allowed me to grow and just continuously, gain respect.
Sure. Are there any particular female mentors that you would like to shout out for us?
Yeah, I think the first is Danielle. She's an architect in LA, and she really showed me and a lot of other women in our office at the time that you can do it all. You can be a mom and be a career woman at the same time. And I think, especially in the architecture industry, there's a reputation for like long hours and really being like dedicated to your craft and your work, and it kind of truly kind of like the work life balance thing is work really bleeds into life when you're a designer.
Sure. And so
up until really like getting to work with her, I had questioned whether I could do it all. Like, could I be successful in this field and also be a mom at the same time? And she really paved the way for honestly a lot of us in the office. It's like we just seeing someone else do it and do it so well, and to see how leadership in the office didn't treat her any differently.
Yeah.
And how she was actually a better architect and a better designer after she became a mother, because of, I think it really like your priorities are set and you just grow so much as a person when you become a mom. And so I think she brought all that into her work and actually was even better as a mother architect. So she's really one that I'll always like thank her for paving the way for us.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, wait, is she also at Perkins and Will? Where did you say you two were?
She was at Clive Wilkinson Architects.
At Clive Wilkinson.
Yeah.
Okay.
And she's just fantastic. And now I've met her clone, I swear. I actually told her this. I'm like, you have a doppelganger in Dallas who just like reminds me so much of her. Kristen here at the Perkins and Will Dallas office is a project architect, and she is the most confident, eloquent, just beautiful person on the inside and out. And I really enjoyed getting to know her, and being in interviews with her is just inspiring. She commands the room. She just has so much confidence, but also like approachability at the same time, which I think is a hard thing to balance.
Hard balance, yeah.
I've learned even in the short time of getting to know her, just being with her in professional environments like interviews and client presentations is just very inspiring. And she leads a group here who basically trains kind of the next project architects, up and coming project architects. And that just goes such a long way to just show representation as a woman, like leading that group and making a difference, for the less experienced staff here. So shout out to her as well.
It's not easy for any of us to jump back into the workplace as a mom, but I'm so glad to hear that you had these women to look up to. What are some pieces of advice you would give to some up and coming female superstars in our industry? What would you like to pass along to them?
I think the most important thing is to just advocate for yourself. I feel like men do a really great job of asking for what they deserve or what they feel like they deserve, aid to ask for it. So I think continuously advocate for yourself, seek opportunities for advancement. Like, that's just something that I think women just, for whatever reason, it's some of the gender bias and the stereotypes, like just we feel like we can't do that as assertively. And so I think just keep in the back of your mind that you can be confident, be assertive, like believe in yourself. Don't hesitate to express yourself in a male-dominated field. And what will happen then is you will find the men and the other women who appreciate
and value an assertive woman. And those, those are the people that you'll want to align yourself with and continue working with. And there's a lot of people that appreciate that. So I think it's, you know, knowing that, that it's okay to, you know, advocate for yourself. And I think staying passionate, just continuously growing and continuously educating yourself. And like I said, building that strong support network. So once you have that confidence and you're asserting yourself, you will find those people and you'll connect with those people who can offer support and guidance along the way and who will, you know, want you to keep being at the table. And and those are the people you want to keep working with in the industry. So
for sure.
Yeah.
What about as the mom of a little girl, what do you hope that she sees in you every day?
I hope she sees a independent, strong, smart person who is just really passionate about what she does. I think in talking, like when I was younger, my father would say, "Oh yeah, like, I go to work and, you know, I do well, but I don't really love what I do." And he was really honest with me about it when I was kind of trying to decide what I wanted to do as a career. I think that was, I'm so happy that he was honest and truthful about it, because a lot of people don't really talk about that. But he really pushed me to go into a field where I was passionate about what I was doing. And he said, take the time to find out what you're passionate about. You're not going to find out right away. But once you do find that, you know, you can be successful because you will enjoy working. You will enjoy what you do. You'll enjoy seeing the results of all of your hard work. And ultimately you'll be more successful at it because you're passionate about it. So I really owe it to him for like being truthful about maybe his dissatisfaction with, you know, his career path that he's chosen, and wanting to make sure that, you know, his kids really enjoyed what they were doing. So I want my daughter to do the same. Like, I want her to see that I'm not just working to work. Like, there is more of a reward than just a paycheck for me. There's seeing how design can really impact the human experience, I think is really important to me. And I do get such reward, like working on projects where you really see just how it has changed people's lives to either work in the space or the school in the space you designed for, or be in a hospital that you design. All these things, like, it really does change people's lives if they're in a wonderful environment. So
for sure. Is there anything else that you wanted to add into this? Any topic that you wanted to touch upon?
There was a question about like activity-based working and
How would you define that, activity-based work models?
Yeah, activity-based working is like truly what it says, which is you're designing for the different activities and you're recognizing that different activities require different environments. So you're really, it starts with a deep dive into that department or team, because it will vary throughout an organization, especially a large one that has a variety of different departments within it. You'll want to find out what are those primary activities that or tasks is another way to think about it, that team does throughout the day. So I'll use our studio as an example, because we're actually going through a little bit of a little studio refresh project ourselves. We started looking at, okay, what are those activities? It's selecting finishes. It's, you know, on the computer doing our drawings. It's meetings, but there's different types of meetings. So what are those various different types of meetings? There's the more formal meetings where you really need to be in a meeting room. Then there's the kind of like impromptu meetings with just a few of you where you don't necessarily need to be in a formal setting. There's several other, you know, there's things like that require maybe monitors, like larger dual monitors for your work versus checking emails or something that can just be done on a laptop. So he kind of outlines like the top 10 or so activities that could do throughout the day. And then we started looking at, okay, what then are the best like furniture and just kind of spaces that facilitate that type of activity? Because right now we're doing everything at our desk, but is that really like the best place to review finished samples? Probably not. Like we probably want to be standing up at a long layout table, you know, next to a window so you get that great daylight on the finishes. It's probably better to look at that on like a 10-foot long layout table than a like a small 4-foot desk. You know, so it's like thinking about what would be ideal to work on your laptop be. Probably you don't need to be at a desk. You could be like sitting with your laptop in your lap and like a cozy chair or something, you know, a lounge chair. So it was identifying all of those things. And then it's kind of laying those out and making sure you have the right ratios and mix of those different spaces to support the team. So what it ends up being is it creates that variety and choice that we were talking about earlier that just gives employees like those options. When they're working on that certain task, they can go to this space to do it versus just trying to do everything at your desk. And it definitely just, you know, creates a more inclusive environment, a more supports that neurodiversity. And ultimately it's all about being more functional. It's better supporting like those tasks and making everything not only more beautiful and more variety and diversity, but more functional as well.
Right. Now, is it a newer way to approach design? Does it kind of fall under the universal design principles, or is this something that's always been?
It's been around for a while. But I feel like the pandemic and like everyone working remotely for a while and then in a more hybrid way now, it's kind of lit the fire underneath it, I would say, because I think as people are coming back into the office, they're questioning, like, why am I here if I can just do some of this work at home? And so how can the office better support the work that I do? Like the office should be a better place to work than your home office. And so taking this activity-based approach definitely gets you closer to having the right space for that person to like feel really effective when they're in the office. So I think it has had a little bit of a resurgence or just maybe kind of escalated the amount of companies that are more interested in going that route versus kind of the standard kind of one size fits all office spaces of the past. So we're definitely seeing more and more interest in it. And what's the best way to really execute it is to be free address. So be unassigned, where you can really float to these different settings. So it takes a lot of collaboration with HR and others like within the organization to make sure that the kind of policy aligns with the space and that people are, because it's a huge change to go from being in an assigned desk or cubicle or private office to having the ability to kind of work anywhere in the office. Right.
Yeah, sure.
And having that autonomy to do so and permission to do so from like a manager perspective. It requires a lot of training and a lot of kind of what we call change management in the industry, but preparation for the change and working with HR and technology and like other groups, other stakeholders within the organizations is super important for it to ultimately succeed. Because you can provide all these different spaces, but if people don't know how to use them and people don't feel like they have the permission to use them, it doesn't go over very well.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the perfect place to end it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.